യോഗേന ചിത്തസ്യ പദേന വാചാം മലം ശരീരസ്യ ച വൈദ്യകേന യോപാക്രോതം പ്രവരം മുനീനാം പതഞ്ജലിം പ്രാഞ്ജലിരാനതോസ്മി സ്തുവേ പതഞ്ജലിം വ്യാസം ശങ്കരം ച മുനിത്രയം കർത്തൃസൂത്രസ്യ ഭാഷ്യസ്യ ക്രമാവിവരണസ്യ ച. So we are continuing the discussion of the Samadhipada. For your information, you know, within a few weeks we will shift the classes to the renovated old temple. So the remaining sutras of Kaivalyapada we may finish very quickly, and you know, then we'll start a new text when we shift the classes to the old temple. So I think I have already discussed the early part of the ninth sutra of Kaivalyapada, fourth chapter. This sutra is very important. Many modern writers who have studied Yoga Sutra, including the early translators, have noted some very interesting implications explaining the mystery of human character that you find in this sutra. The sutra is this: jati desha kala vivahitanam anandadyam smriti samskarayoho ekarupatvat. So the sutra is very simple. That is, there is a continuity in desires. The simple translation I'll explain gradually. There is a continuity in desires, or what you call, I mean, the zest, enthusiasm for life, material life, even though we may be separated in terms of jati, desha and kala, species, space and time. The sutra may not be very obvious when you look at this. What this means is this. Patanjali tells you, and also you, Buddhist philosophers also tell you, and Vedanta also, that death is not the end of our life. Death is only a transition point. It is only a semicolon or a comma, not a full stop. So whatever we do in this life will remain in our mental world called chittam in the form of subtle tendencies. And in fact, the description of this tendency is one of the unique contributions of Vyasa's commentary on Yoga Sutra. Vyasa Bhashyam is the most authentic and the first explanatory book on the Yoga Sutras. As you know, Yoga Sutras, the text contains 195 sutras, which are all aphorisms, which if you just read, you won't understand the true meaning. But the succession of students and teachers who came in that parambara, in the succession, from time to time, they explained, described and handed over to the next generation of students the true implication of these sutras. That's how we come to know today. So those commentators whom I normally refer to, whom I quote from, are Vyasa Bhashya, and then Vyasa Bhashya Vivarana, written by Shankaracharya, and then Tattva Vaisharathi, and then Yoga Bhashya Vartigam of Vijnana Bhikshu, Tattva Vaisharathi of Vajaspati Misra, Bhoja's Raja Martanda and Bhoja Vritti, and of course recently a great Swami who lived in 19th century wrote a book, Hariharananda Vidyaranya. He wrote Hariharananda Aranya, he wrote this Bhaswati, which is a small book. So these are the texts which I normally quote. If those who are interested, you know, in the videos you get these quotations from Sanskrit which you can refer to. So what is the meaning of this sutra? See, what it means is our experiences, including our actions, in which we get involved, which are our experiences. Experiences coming from outside, external sources, and also experiences within our own mental world, our anger, our hunger, our thirst, etc. All these become subtle residual forms. They are called vrittis, and these vrittis again get solidified. They become impressions, which is the translation by Vivekananda to the particular Sanskrit word samskara. Now, samskara cannot really be translated in English, because you know, when you translate one technical word from one civilizational heritage to another civilizational heritage, much of the meaning could be lost unless we explain it. So, our experiences, our actions, our thoughts, our deeds, words we speak, all become eventually vrittis. They become samskaras. And that means we are all born with different samskaras. Now, that means in all of us, there is a Jesus Christ, there is a Buddha, there is also a Hitler and a Genghis Khan, all of us. It means good and bad, that's what it means. It's a metaphor, I'm using the word, not as individually. So, in all of us, there are wonderful samskaras, wonderful impressions, and also impressions which are not so very wonderful. So, when do they manifest? When we contact with persons with good samskaras, then the good samskaras stored up in our mental system will come to the surface, and we may act according to the influence of those samskaras. And also when we come in contact with wrong persons, wrong associations, wrong places, for example, if we go to Alcatraz, this prison, and go to a church, what's the difference? Same concrete and mortar, same engineer may have constructed every holy temple or a church or a synagogue, and also this Alcatraz, made of the same material, Panchamahabhudas, five elements. The word is, where does the difference come from? The difference comes from the type of persons who may live there. That means when they think certain thoughts, they contribute to the environment. We may call it negative vibrations, negative samskaras. That's why people go to holy places. A holy pilgrim center is also made of concrete and mortar. What's the difference? The difference being within that building, within that structure, there is a huge reservoir, a huge collection of positive samskaras, impressions, and when you go there, the good samskaras you have accumulated maybe 1,000 years back will come to the surface and will connect with those samskaras. So you feel a kind of feeling at home. So we can check where we stand in the scale of culture and evolution according to the feeling, according to the way we feel at home where we go. If you feel at home in a place where there is a collection of holy thoughts and holy ideas, then you feel the positive thought currents you have stored up in the mental system come to the surface and they connect. So you feel at home. You feel, I've seen people telling, you know, they use the word energy, which is, I don't think, is a very satisfactory way of looking at the whole picture. They will say, I felt great energy when I came to the temple. It's really that kind of enthusiasm or energy is not what it means. Perhaps what they mean is there is a reduction of conflict in the mental world, which they feel as a manifestation of energy. So what this sutra tells you is this. This jati means species, space, kala means time, and desha means space. So according to the type of people whom you associate with, and the place where you live, and also the circumstances where you interact with people, all those eventually decide what kind of samskaras will come to your surface. That's what the sutra essentially means. There may be separation, of course, you know. So let us say you go to a holy place, holy thoughts and samskaras come to the surface. The holy thoughts you have accumulated in the mental system, they come to the surface and they connect with the holy vibrations in the church or a temple or a synagogue or Buddhist temple, wherever it is. But you have accumulated these holy thoughts maybe 1,000 years back. So there is kala, you know, it is separation in terms of kala. That is, the point is, jati, desha, kala, vyavahitanam. That means, there is a separation, separated by jati, desha and kala. So you are separated from the previous experiences maybe by thousands of years, by centuries. Maybe you are meditating 2,000 years back. You were a great spiritual mystic 1,000 years back. Then course of time, you also accumulated certain impressions which are not so very desirable. So what happens in a vyavakhitanam? So those good samskaras get covered, or they do not manifest. Why? Because you happen to live among people whose association did not encourage the manifestation of these good samskaras. So that is why, you know, that is why jati vyavahitana, desha vyavahitanam, kala vyavahitanam, that is the sutra should be divided into different formations. Separated by species, maybe you are a wonderful, a very contemplative elephant. You look at Buddha's Jataka's tales. I think there is no greater example than Buddha's Jataka tales. 548 previous life cycles he had to go through when he sat under the tree meditating. But in each of these, he was an elevated person. He was a king in certain life cycles. He was a prince. He was a beggar. He was a wanderer. He was an elephant. And he was a lion with a great philosophical perspective, you find it. So in Buddha's Jataka tales, there is a gradual manifestation, increasingly more and more manifestation of Buddhahood. Finally, he was born, the last birth, he was born as the real Buddha, Prince Siddhartha, as the son of a great king, Suddhodana in Nepal. And he became Buddha. This is all about Buddha's Jataka tales, what I'm talking about. So, maybe there is a separation in terms of species or place. Place also plays a very important, will play a very important role. So, that's why, you know, small children should be given an opportunity to grow in circumstances, but the circumstances do not prompt the undesirable tendencies stored up in their mental system, and will bring to the surface the desirable tendencies in the children. So remember, Patanjali totally refuted John Locke. In short, John Locke said that you are born with a tabula rasa, empty table, empty slate. If that is the most inaccurate, totally false analysis you can make of mind and human character. That's what John Locke said. Patanjali says, no, we are not born with empty slate. We are born with lot of things written on the slate. these samskaras, vrittis, impressions already there. So that's why many of these good samskaras may be separated, may be covered, concealed by a wrong place where you are born. So biological heredity is only an accident according to Vedanta. There is a different kind of heredity. Heredity that comes from so many life cycles. So biological heredity, parentage, the culture of your parents which you may have inherited as you claim, it is only the tip of the iceberg. Only tiny fraction of our true personality. So what really happens is, these samskaras, they get accumulated in the mental system. And certain samskaras begin to manifest. And those samskaras are responsible for the present embodiment and life. And there is a huge reservoir of samskaras which remain and manifest. That is called sanchita karma. Karma here means not really action. Karma means samskara. So this is called prarabdha. What is already started manifesting, but you're responsible for the present embodiment, the present life and experiences, is like an arrow that has left the bow. It is on a flight towards the target. That's what it is. Again, it is not predeterminism. Great Vedantins like Shankaracharya has tried to reconcile human effort and grace. Vedanta doesn't believe in a kind of predeterminism, either Calvinistic predeterminism or predeterminism of Madhvacharya. In India also there was Madhva believed in predeterminism. There are certain people who have permanent residence in heaven, hell, will never get salvation. So Calvin also, you know, everything is a free gift from God, Lutheran Calvinistic concept, where you don't play any role, no use praying. That's why they do completely reject the saints and those who are elevated persons. Everything is a free gift from God. So everything is predetermined. So yoga doesn't say that. Yoga says we may go through many experiences, but still we can bring about a change in our own destiny by our effort and through spiritual practices. That's why the yoga becomes relevant. So coming to the subject. So these accumulated samskaras, vrittis, impressions can be separated, can be concealed, can be modified according to the place where you are living and also according to the time when you are living. So manifestation can depend upon so many factors. Otherwise, how do you explain a man like, there was a disciple, you know, an American disciple, Ramana Maharshi's disciple. His name was, I forgot. Just heard about Ramana Maharshi and went there and studied, and that he never turned back. So, of course, I'm not going to those, you know, those stories. What the Yoga Sutra tells you is this: we may have accumulated so many good and bad samskaras in the past. So, those samskaras alone will manifest in our life, present life. And that will depend upon the place where you are living and also the persons with whom we associate. And of course the circumstances in which we live. All these can help those samskaras to manifest, to come to the surface. So other samskaras will remain there. They will manifest in course of time. So the message from this sutra is, we should try always to somehow connect ourselves with the sources, with the persons, places and circumstances which will prompt the springing of the manifestation of positive tendencies that are stored up in our mental system. Otherwise, negative tendencies will come to the surface, because both good and bad tendencies are already stored up in the mental system. So the more and more positive samskaras emerge, the more and more it becomes helpful for us to progress in spiritual life. And that will, the first sign that you are accumulating positive samskaras is that you feel less conflict when you try to meditate. You feel less conflict when you try to do something noble. You feel no conflict when you try to do something which is spiritually elevating. If you ever experience any conflict or tension when we try to do something good, it means these negative samskaras coming from previous life cycles where we lived in a different century, different era, in a different set of circumstances, those samskaras are coming to the surface, blocking. And this happens in the form of a mental block. It's a mental block. That's what is called the conflict between what we want to do and what our mind allows us to do. So that is a unique contribution of Vyasa, actually. Vyasa is the first exponent of this concept of samskara. So I have already explained many times what samskara is, but I shall try to explain once more. Whatever we do, that action doesn't end the moment a result is produced. Action here doesn't mean physical action, verbal action, speaking a word, hearing a word. Mental action, remembering, thinking, ideas coming to the mind, in the mind. All these are included in this action, karma. Karma is a Sanskrit word. So action is only a very small, tiny fraction of the true implication of the word karma. Kridhatu. Krimi kurudedi kru means anything where you involved in something, mentally, physically, intellectually, verbally, all can leave behind something in our mental system, in our character. It is called vritti. So this vritti is called residual effect. That's how it is translated. The word is spoken, the action is done, the thought has disappeared, but something remains in our system as a residual effect of these actions, experiences. These tendencies become more solidified, they become strong, they go deeper, and they become a tendency, a samskara. And once you produce a samskara, it's like a seed that you've sown. The seed has to sprout. If it doesn't sprout right now, it means the soil is not good. It means the soil is not appropriate, not conducive for the growth of the sprout. So the seed is there. We have sown a seed in our mental world. It will manifest. Yoga is all about burning the seed, burning and neutralizing the fertility of the seed. That means chitta vritti nirodha means when vrittis get completely transcended, when mind becomes pure, reaches the highest degree of purity or perfection, then all the seeds, all the residual effects, all the vrittis get completely neutralized through yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. This ashtanga yoga is a means to burn the seeds. There also Buddha's chatvari, ari, satyani, this also means his nirvana is the way of burning the seed. Means once you burn the seed or cook the seed, then it cannot sprout. Till then it remains there as a potential tree. One day there is a potential within the seed to become a tree. So But again, coming to the subject, the point is, every action lives in the mental world a vritti, and these vrittis become samskaras. And samskaras, unless you take to yoga, samskaras will sprout and become a tree. If you put a poisonous thought in our mental world, mental system, it can become a poisonous tree in course of time. Maybe not in this life cycle, in another life cycle. So, of course, the yoga, Patanjali yoga system is not only path. Bhakti yoga is one, the path of devotion, the path of selfless action, karma yoga, the path of jnana. All these are different paths of burning and baking and maybe cooking the seed so that these seeds will no more sprout. So, transcending the vrittis, transcending these samskaras. Till we achieve this niruddha state of the vrittis, these samskaras will remain there and they will manifest one day. If it doesn't manifest today, it's because the place in which we are living is not conducive. Or the persons with whom we associate with may suppress the tendency for this undesirable tendency to manifest. If you are living in the company of good persons, wrong tendencies will not manifest, but they will be there. And for that, we have to undertake the journey. We have to practice meditation, japa, or any of the yogas. Then only we can transcend the effect of the impressions of tendencies. So, smriti samskara yoh ekatvat. What it means is, Now, these samskaras, vasanas, tendencies will continue, though separated by maybe thousands of years of life cycles, hundreds of life cycles. Maybe you may have accumulated a tendency or samskara in a totally different alien culture in which you lived maybe several centuries back. A good samskara could be. Those good samskaras will one day manifest wherever you are living when we associate or connect with those samskaras by reading a book, by listening to an idea, then it could happen. See, look at a man like Max Muller. Poor man, he was commissioned by the church to translate Vedas to edit Vedas in English. And the church gave him a holy commission. That means to show Hindus what absolute gibberish Vedas are. That is his mission. Once he started reading the Vedas, he became a convert. He was a German who lived in London, in Oxford. And this man started reading the Vedas, he never looked back. So Vivekananda met him and his wife in Oxford, near Oxford, his home. And Vivekananda says, he looked like the Vasishtha and Arundhati, two ancient Vedic sages who may have lived thousands of years back. When Vivekananda met this German scholar living in Oxford, he thought, this man is like a great sage who lived in ancient Vedic times. The poor man was commissioned by the church to publish Vedas so that the whole world will know what absolute rubbish the Vedas are. And that was the beginning of Vedic message coming and spreading and practically flooding the whole Western world. So what happened to him? When he took up this mission, what happened, he suddenly, it's like Sri Ramakrishna says in the gospel, certain, there are some spiritual seekers, once they start doing little spiritual practice, a whole flood of spring water will come to the surface. It just like hit the rock, and that rock is you are opening a spring. The whole well or lake may be flooded with water in no time. You accidentally hit a rock because beneath there is a huge reservoir of pure water. That's what happened to Max Muller. So that's what happens. Why? This man must have associated, must have lived in an atmosphere of Vedic culture and Vedic heritage, maybe several life cycles earlier. And then he happened to be born in Germany of German parentage, came to England as a professor, an Indologist, and then accidentally when this man read it, he never looked back. And he never went to India. Vivekananda asked him, did you go to India? No. Why? You will have to bury me there because you have to come back. You won't be able to come back. That is Max Müller's famous reply to Vivekananda. No, if I go there, you have to bury me there. He will not come back. So, that's a jadi desha kala vivahidanam anandaryam. So, what is smriti samskara yoho ekarupatvat? Smriti means memory. And samskara means strong tendencies, which are the solidified forms of vrittis. They are the same. They remain intact. No matter where you are born, no matter how many thousands of years back, you may have accumulated or you may have acquired these great tendencies. They will be there, they will manifest even if you try your best not to let it manifest. It could happen by mere accident. It could happen. So that's the meaning of the ninth sutra. The one term is very important, smriti samskara yoho ekatvat. So smriti means memory, samskara means impressions. Because there is close identification, integrity, interrelatedness between memories and samskaras and impressions. The next sutra is this. Tasam anadittum cha asisho nityatvat. Now, these vasanas, that's the meaning of tasam. Tasam anadittum cha asishaka nityatvat. That is the cross order. So these vasanas, they are there, they are eternal, that is anadityam. Why? What is this? This thirst for happiness is one way of reading. But it is based on thirst for life. An instant, a strong thirst, enthusiastic desire for continuing the enjoyment of worldly pleasures. This continues. So long as this strong desire, that's what Buddha also says, you know, Pratitya Samutpada. Buddha speaks of this 12 link forming a wheel or a cycle. But the basis of this cycle, the continuing wheel of birth, life, death and rebirth is called Pratitya Samutpada, dependent origination. Each has got a cause. Each is dependent upon its cause. So it goes on rotating. Birth, life, death and rebirth. The reason is, there is always what you call Trishna, the same. You know, many of the Buddhists were great commentators of Vedic yoga scriptures. The Yogacara system, which is called Vijnanavada, itself got a name because these Buddhist monks belong into that particular idealistic school, practice yoga, and they were great practitioners and interpreters of yoga psychology. So, Yogacara system of the Buddhists. So, Buddha also says the same thing. Thirst for life. Thirst for enjoyment. So, thirst for happiness. It is always the asishaka nityatvad. Asisha means jivadecha. Desire for continuing life. Just please don't remember, don't ever get away with the wrong notion that Yoga Sutra is negative. What it means, here Jivadecha Ashisha, here means continuing mysterious desire for worldly enjoyments. That's what it implies. Well, the best way to explain is in the words of Sri Ramakrishna. Sri Ramakrishna says, you know, this camel living in a desert goes on eating thorny bush, and his whole mouth is bleeding, his tongue is bleeding, and is undergoing terrible pain, but the blood drops give a kind of excitement. It becomes an addiction. So the camel goes on eating more and more thorny bush and goes on suffering more and more. It cannot get out of it. There is a particular state of human mind where you start looking upon suffering as enjoyment. Eating thorny bush, a thorny bush becomes the manna, you know, the divine food. That's a terrible state of condition. When you look upon misery, what normally or eventually makes life miserable becomes our ultimate goal in human life. That's a very serious, tragic predicament. We know at the subconscious level that this is going to bring misery to us. Still, we cannot bring our mind to take a decision to get out of this. A kind of obsessive attachment to something which we know to be the source of all problems. It is called jivitecha here. So literal translation should not lead us to any misunderstanding. It is not a negative approach to life as a whole. What it means is, even though we know there are certain things in life which are the real source of all problems, and we want to get out of it sincerely, but we feel a mysterious and inexplicable, indescribable attachment to that, no matter how strong our desire to get out of this stranglehold is, still we cannot bring ourselves to making a real effort to get out of this trap. Now, this is a continuing phenomenon. That is asisha, it is called, means. So, in fact, you know, this can have another form. A strong desire to go for something wonderful and a strong desire to get rid of something which is really the source of all troubles. But because of our desire, we cannot get out of it. Why? So long as this remains, the vasanas, tasamanadittvam, these vasanas, these desires, these tendencies, which constitute the fuel of human life, it remains there. You cannot get out of this. That is the 10th sutra. What happens, you know, desires produce experiences which may be good and bad, so we want to come out of it, but that desire itself becomes a stumbling block. The next sutra is also very important. Hedu phalasriya lampanehi samgrihidattvat esham abhave tad abhavaha. This is the sutra. It's a very somewhat long sutra. So, there are a few terms used here. Hedu, phala, asraya. So, hedu. Hedu actually means the cause. That is, what is the cause of our tendencies? What's the cause of our actions becoming samskaras, impressions or tendencies? We do certain things, we speak certain words, we undergo certain experiences. Long after those experiences are left behind, something is left in the mental system which remains as a samskara, And this samskara continues, and that eventually becomes a trap. And we can get out of this only when we reach the highest chitta vritti nirodha, which is the goal of yoga. What's the cause? What transforms our actions, our experiences into samskaras? What can prevent them from becoming samskaras? Raga and dvesha, these are the two words used in Sanskrit. Raga means attachment, which are linked to desire. Dvesha means its opposite, its opposite, aversion. That's how mind always functions. If we are attached to certain things, obsessive attachment, extreme liking for certain things, it is certain that we will have extreme dislike for certain other things. Because our aversion to certain things express as our extreme attachment to the opposite of that. Yoga means going beyond both. They are like two sides of the same coin. You cannot have a coin with only one side. So, raga and dvesha, extreme liking for certain things that may give temporary happiness, and extreme aversion to certain things which may not give happiness all the time, this is responsible. These two mental attitudes are responsible for converting actions and experiences into samskaras. And samskaras become a trap. So I think it's very clear. That is hedu phala asraya lambanaihi. They go together. Hedu means the cause. Just before the desire, what causes the desire? Phala means the result for actions. Asraya means there are many dependent factors. So they together exist, and because of this, our actions become samskaras. So now we will have interaction after interaction. During interaction, because today's topic, that we certain topics are newly introduced, so you can, things are not very clear, you are most welcome to ask questions and I will respond to them.
What is the importance of Vedantic astrology? And does the soul know where it's going? Is it a pilgrimage of the Atman? Is it a journey with its own inherent intelligence? Because we have a contemporary situation with the development of the ego, and then we have the Atman. And the ego can either work for or against the evolution of the spirit or the soul. So is there a place for Vedantic astrology as an auxiliary or a spiritual help in the evolution of the individual?
Yeah. You know, astrology is just a matter of calculation. It's like mathematics. There is nothing occult about it. In true astrology, it's like a science. So all great astrologers will tell you, this is just a calculation. They won't tell you this is going to happen for certain. They will tell you this is what our present calculations tell us. That is the difference between a genuine astrologer and a fake. A fake astrologer will tell you, play $100 and I will change your whole life. And this is going to happen to you. A genuine astrologer will tell you, well, this is a science, and there is a way of calculation based on the position of stars, position of the galaxies, Milky Ways, and your previous life, samskaras, which they try to ascertain by observing your body, some of your experiences. So they put together, they come to some kind of a conclusion, and they will say, this is what the person, what the stars tell you. But they won't consider, true astrologers won't tell you astrological conclusions to be infallible or non-negotiable. They will say, it is what the present state. So, astrology is considered to be Ardhashastra. Ardhashastra means half science. All science are half science. Because what science tells you today, it changes its view tomorrow. After 50 years, paradigms change. See, the great Berkeley physicist, Thomas Kuhn, who wrote K-U-H-N. He wrote a well-known book, The Revolution of Thomas Kuhn, 1962 or 61 publication. The Revolution of Scientific Discoveries. His great contribution was the concept of paradigm shift in scientific discoveries. So he says, scientific discoveries do not happen one after another, just A plus A, B, C, D, like that, 1, 2, 3. Frequently, a number of scientific ideas and discoveries together constitute a paradigm. This paradigm may again change after a certain period. So I think, scientific revolutions, that's a word here. Not revolution in that word. It means going on revolving cycles of scientific discoveries, as it means. The structure of scientific revolutions, you may write down. The structure of scientific revolutions, that's a book which I quoted from that book extensively in one of, I quoted, I mean, I recited some portion on Sunday lecture. So he says this is a paradigm shift. What does it mean? Science also is a, Ardhashastra in Sanskrit means half science. It is not certain. Maybe law of karma is certain in a much more scientific and acceptable sense than the so-called modern science. Because discoveries in physics could get modified. They don't become total lies, but they become lesser truths. Because as the science progresses, moves forward, more and more discoveries come up. And then the early discoveries, they are of course confirmed, but there will be modifications so that the early paradigms become less true. I mean, less absolute, less paramount. So he was the one who wrote the well-known book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, 62-61. The idea is taken, according to some thinkers, from Jewish prophetic tradition, their theology, God's commandments, from installments, as time progresses, more and more of God's wisdom is revealed. Each prophet in that, or a few prophets together, constitute one paradigm. So they say he took this idea. Anyway, I'm not coming to that. I'm not a physicist nor a Jewish theologian. So, but I want to tell you is, astrology should not be taken very seriously by true Vedantins. Just as we don't take science very seriously when we go to philosophy, especially transcendental philosophy. So, Vedanta deals with the trans-empirical, the higher truths which stress the relativity, the comparative relativity of empirical world. The world is not the absolute reality. Vedanta deals with something that designates the empirical reality as something subservient or irrelevant in the higher context. It is relevant in its own context. But from a transcendental paramarthika viewpoint, empirical reality and astrology, which is relevant only in empirical world, is of no great significance. And that's why great astrologers will always tell you Well, the rest, if you pray to God, all this will change. It's a Phalavibhaga, Vede, Parihara, and you know, great astrologers, they are so sincere. Just as great Vedic scholars are very sincere. The great astrologers will tell you, well, these are the predictions that we can reach on the basis of these ideas, but it's not the absolute. If you pray to God, if you change your lifestyle, it can change. That's the sign of a genuine astrologer, okay? Who is not for money, okay.
Apart from the longer questions, I have a short question.
Yeah.
It's about that dramatic transformation of Max Müller.
Yeah.
And I'd be interested to know if there are any biographies of that gentleman that you would recommend.
Oh, yeah. Ramakrishna Mission has published a biography. I can recommend maybe
Thank
late.
You.
Yeah, wonderful books. Yeah. It was a dramatic transformation. Not only Max Müller. This happened to Aquitaine Dupereau, who was a Frenchman who got enlisted in the East India Company infantry and who didn't fight as a soldier, who traveled all over India and who translated some portions of the Upanishads into Latin, which Schopenhauer later happened to read. This may happen in 1801, 1805, around that time. You find this, Henrik, another German scholar. So you find such things happening. I'm giving in the broader context. So when you feel a great elevation, a great indescribable attraction, and with a feeling that this is the thing which I was looking for till now, when you feel, then you reach something, you are discovering something within your own chittam, mental world, some samskaras that you have deposited there, you are discovering right now. Otherwise, you won't feel at home. That's what happens.
Yeah. In reading the sutras, if one finds part of it is difficult, is your advice to go backwards and read it again, or to keep going forwards and finish, and then eventually go back to the beginning?
Sutras, we're talking about?
Sutras,
yeah.
In general.
Sutras, we can't read the sutras as we read a novel or a book. In fact, that's why frequently, you know, when I teach the sutras, I frequently quote from all the four chapters. So, for example, you know, in the printed book, you get the text, the structure of the text, Samadhibhada, then Sadhanabhada, Vibhudibhada, and Kaivalyabhada. I mean, on concentration, on practices, on powers, and on liberation. I'm just giving English equivalents. Now, if you begin with, let us say, Samadhibhada, and go to the end of it, Samadhi means concentration. And concentration is the result of practices. So you have to begin with practices, which is actually the second chapter in the printed book, really speaking, you know. So actually, we should begin with Sadhanapada on practices, which actually the chapter second in all printed books. All the manuscripts happen to be like that. That's why in all printed books, it is given the same order. First concentration, then practices, then powers, the effects of yoga, and then liberation. But in real life, you practice first, then so many powers and results, and then concentration, and then liberation. This is the real order. But there is a reason why, that's the only logical explanation. There is a reason why the Samadhipada comes first, because some of the vital definitions that we normally should study very well before entering yoga appear in the Samadhipada. For example, why we take to yoga, Atha Yoga Anushasanam? Now onwards we are discussing yoga. It comes Samadhipada. And yoga sitta vritti nirodha, definition of yoga. The definition should come first. And there are many other, the list of vrittis, vrittaya panchadaya, klishta, klishta, all will come only in the Samadhipada. So Samadhipada, for the first few sutras, till about 8, 9, 10 sutras, they deal with some basic descriptions and definitions of some of the vital concepts in yoga. So what I do normally, I will deal with the first few sutras of Samadhipada, then I don't continue, then I come to the Sadhanapada, which means the practices. After completing that chapter, I go to Samadhipada again, complete the whole text, and then gradually, of course, after Sadhanapada, I go to Vibhutipada, and Samadhi comes third. Please remember this. So there is one order in which the book is printed. All books, everywhere, all manuscripts, that is Samadhi, concentration, then Sadhana, that is practices, Vibhuti, the powers, and liberation, Kaivalyapada. But the basic definition, introduction to the yoga dynamics, the dynamics of yoga psychology, appear in the first few sutras of Samadhipada, which is actually the second chapter in the printed book. So in our real life, how do you begin? You should begin with practices and then the results. Then concentration, which is a result of practices. And then liberation, which is ultimate last part. But then there is a reason, there is a logic. Why is Samadhi Pada is printed first? The reason is, the early sutras of Samadhi Pada contain the definitions and introductions of yoga, vritti and so on. And the epistemology, all that. Sutras you find, pramanas, etc. That's why in real life, you begin with practices, then results of powers, then concentration, and then liberation. But in printed book, in all printed books, throughout, you begin with concentration, then practices, then powers, results, and then liberation. Okay, I hope you understand. Now, why this diversity, the difference? Because these sutras were all taught by the great teachers in different places according to a tradition. And they were all orally taught and orally studied. So, in that succession, they knew what they were studying. So, the context of studying in a modern academic setting perhaps didn't occur to them. That's why the text appeared like that. As for I can tell you, the best way for a Westerner to understand yoga is Vivekananda's translation. The reason is, Swami Vivekananda has given a very simple, straightforward interpretation. Not only translation, but also interpretation. And if you read the translations of traditional yoga scholars, they frequently try to do justice to the original text, with the result that it becomes totally unintelligible to those who don't get an opportunity to study under a teacher. But Vivekananda gives a very simple interpretation, keeping in mind the needs of an English, modern English-speaking world. That is Vivekananda's greatness. And he knew what he was talking about. Swami Vivekananda himself had experienced all this. So there is a touch of personal experience that you find in Vivekananda, which you can feel when you read it. But even then, there are many, many areas where you need some explanation. So for any Western student of yoga, the best book even now is Swami Vivekananda's translation. For two reasons, he keeps in mind the needs and the needs of the modern Western world, And he also has the background of his own personal experience of what he's talking about. So the best way to enter the world of yoga is Vivekananda's translation, Raja Yoga.
And that's the two books that are over, the book that's over there.
Yeah. That's a book. That's a book.
Yeah, I've got
we have displayed those books. Yeah. Very simple.
I've got it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, thank you. Yeah. One more question.
Yes, sure.
Swami Vivekananda's translations you can buy from our bookstore anytime. Okay.
What is the Vedantic view of the Akasha records?
Of the?
The Akasha records. Like, there are certain records, historical records of everyone. When I was in Calcutta, there was a Mr. Mukherjee, Banerjee, and he was an astrologer as well. And the maybe I'm mispronouncing the Akasha records.
There are. Oh, yeah, yeah. Actually, I don't have any knowledge about it.
Oh, okay.
To be very frank.
Okay.
So I'm not an astrologer, but so I'm coming from a land where the ancient astrologers have practiced this for the last 3,000 years. Long ancient families. So one uniqueness about a traditional Orthodox astrologer and a modern one is the traditional astrologer who knows Sanskrit. And who also do a lot of meditation, they will tell you not only the greatness of astrology, but also the limitation of astrology. That is the uniqueness of it. In India, the more orthodox, the more conservative, the more traditional, and the more profound a scholar is, the more scientific and unprejudiced his view will be. There are people who practice astrology. You give their name, the computer screen, you press enter, and you get all your horoscope. I don't know much about it. But I'm not talking about that kind of modern astrology. I'm talking about ancient families who have been practicing astrology for maybe 3,000 years. That's what I'm talking about. They are very rational, totally free from any prejudice. They will tell you, this is the present situation as we find. It could change. But as I mentioned to you, great astrologers will tell you it is Ardha Shastra. Ardha means half. And a great scientist will tell you, a great physicist will tell you, tomorrow perhaps modern science will bring for new discoveries. If a scientist tells you that modern science has exhausted all wisdom, all knowledge, he is no better than a religious fanatic. Scientific fanaticism is no better than religious fanaticism. But a really great scientist will tell you, science is still progressing. What we consider to be hypothetical theories today may become a verifiable fact tomorrow. That's why if you read the works of great men like Thomas Kuhn, the structure of scientific revolutions, paradigms change. Many, so this is the, this is Stephen Hawking. They step out of the context of mainstream scientists and they are able to look into the future. They are able to look at the whole thing from a transcendental perspective. That is the greatness of a truly great astrologer and also truly great scientist. Both, they may not be friendly when they meet each other, but there are many common grounds in both. Okay, thank you. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.